Succession number 23329, reel 25.
Younger, reel 25.
He went on. I hate them even more since I've seen what they've done to you folks. Well, we were all a little embarrassed by this, but we realised that this had been part of their training. They'd had hatred inculcated into them. I don't think it lasted all that long once the war was over. Anyway, our car was a Hanamag, and there were certain engine parts missing which were replaced, new tyres and tubes, and it was reconverted from a charcoal burning to a petrol burning system. The only problem was the battery was flat, so we tied the car to the back of a tank and were towed into the street. Dick was at the wheel, and as we raced down the cobblestone road behind the tank, there was so much noise and so much vibration that he couldn't tell whether the engine was going or not. It was a short tow rope, and we could see nothing ahead but this vast structure, and swinging from the rear, just in front of our windscreens, were three dead chickens. There were hundreds of cars in the camp. I think every car in every village within miles had been taken. Some men even raided villages that were still in German hands and got taken prisoner again. Others took not only cars but German uniforms for souvenirs, and they wore them and were taken prisoner by our own forces, who were rather sceptical about them. The Kriegi motorist became such a nuisance that Fallingbostel itself was put out of bounds, and the only car that was allowed to drive into the village was Hanamag, and only then, when we had as a passenger a Yugoslav Air Force general. We called him Joe, and he spoke English, which was a mixture of Fowler and the New Testament, both of which he had used to teach himself. Several other of the Yugoslav Air Force officers had also learned English in that way. Their understanding of the language was good, even if they spoke a little quaintly. Joe wanted to paint our names on the Hanamag, and he obtained white paint and a brush from somewhere, and lettered the names of the four of us on each side of the car, and added XPOW and the star, which all Allied vehicles carried. It was strange that Joe, the Yugoslav, was the first person to use the expression XPOWs to us. The following afternoon, he asked us if we would drive him into Fallingbostel, as he had an appointment. We weren't certain that we would be allowed into the village, even with Joe, but we said we'd try. So he went off promising to be ready in half an hour. Seemed to be in a bit of a flurry, and we wondered if somehow he had acquired a girl. when he came back, he was resplendent in his general's uniform, and the appointment was to discuss the future of his countrymen, presumably with the British officers. He said, I am not of the profession of painter of names, you see. Well, we became his official chauffeurs, but one of us had to stay behind whenever the car went into Falling Bostel, because there was only room for four. Often I was the one to drop out. I didn't feel particularly well, and there was plenty of life in the camp. I was the only one of the four of us to see Ralph Reeder's gang show, which suddenly appeared without prior publicity, took over one of the wooden huts, built a stage, and gave a show without any fuss. I hadn't laughed for a long time, and my cheek seemed to hurt. When we decided to drive on a food foraging expedition, the four of us went in the Hanomag. The army had brought in little food, but so far only the spearhead had reached Falling Bostel, and soon the RASC was to bring enormous lorry loads of food, even white bread. But in the meantime, we looked for eggs and chickens. 5 kilometres from the camp, we saw two boys wearing the familiar German army type cap. They had small packs on their back, and Dick stopped the car, beckoned them over, asked them if they were soldiers. They denied it. They said that one was 13 and the other 14. We were quite sure that they'd been in the forest and had been prepared to carry on with a bit of resistance of their own. Maybe they were members of what was called the Werewolf organization at that time. It was a new resistance movement. I don't think it lasted for very long. We wondered what to do with the boys. We reckoned that they'd got homesick and so had left their sniper's hideout, and they just wanted to go home. Perhaps it was lucky that they did. Some British soldiers may have suffered. Well, we decided to order them to walk towards Falling Bostel, and we drove on ahead of them. A couple of hundred yards further on, we saw a British corporal who was guarding the entrance to a drive. We told him about the two boys. The corporal looked as if he thought he should first arrest us, but finally he said, would we mind driving in and telling the CO, and he would nab them if they came past. Well, we found ourselves in the yard of a prosperous farm where an RASC unit had settled itself. A sergeant asked our business, then made us welcome, hurried into the house to find the CO, and the boys were no longer any concern of ours. The soldiers were eager to ask us questions, and we stood in the centre of the farmyard answering them. All around us were trucks and vans just stacked with food, all sorts of wonderful looking stuff. This unit had in fact just given lunch to troops in the area but they'd left trays half covered with apple pie and salmon pie and huge slices of cold meat, hillocks of sliced bread, fruit. So we explained about the march and how we'd been brought back, how we'd acquired the car, and we tried not to look at all the trucks of food. I knew Toby wanted some of that apple pie more than he'd ever wanted anything in his life. Eventually, one soldier who was leaning against the tailboard of the apple pie van remarked, "You blokes are thin, aren't you? Bloody thin. You'll need plenty of real good food in you." Toby tried to look directly at him and not at the trays behind his head. "I reckon," he said. But it was Ron who said, "Look, Corporal, I know this is a hell of a cheek, but could you spare just one little bit of that apple pie each? Not if the troops have to go without, of course," he added. And he laughed rather nervously, and we probably all looked rather strained. And the soldiers stopped talking. They glanced at each other, and rather like people who'd been asked after someone and only then told he was dead. "That's the leftovers," they said. "You can have as much as you like." "Oh, you're not kidding," said Toby. "Let's fix you a real meal," said the corporal. "No, thank you," said Toby. "Just apple pie. Lots of it. I'm fed up with dried peas." The corporal reached for plates and a large ladle. Never enjoyed food more, and we ate far too much and regretted it. But anyway, the Hanamag was admired, and we were given a couple of cans of petrol. The army chap said, "We can give you enough to get you to Paris or Brussels," but we decided against that. There were many prisoners driving looted cars back, and later, of course, we heard that some had sold them very handsomely in Brussels. But the captain in charge of the area had said they were a great hindrance. He pointed out that the war was not over yet. We'd become quite friendly with him, and so in deference to our friendship, we decided that we should wait for official transport. So the following day we drove into the country again, this time without Toby, and we saw about 100 Russians in single file, all carrying boxes on their heads like native porters. So we scouted the area until we found the food magazine from which the boxes had come. They were boxes of sultanas, and we appropriated a box. Then, heading down a woodland lane, which we hoped would lead us to a farm, we came upon six German soldiers who were sprawling under the trees, and their rifles were stacked a few yards away. Well, I wanted to get the hell out of it, but Dick stopped the car, and Ron was out and standing with a rifle pointing at the Germans before they were properly awake. We emptied all but two of the rifle magazines, and then Dick went off in the car to get transport for the prisoners, and Ron and I began to march them back to the camp. They didn't know whether the war was ended or not, and they didn't seem to mind that for them the war was over. The well-worn words of our captors. They had a drink at a horse trough, and then we marched them along the same road that we tramped as prisoners a few days before. There's no sign of Dick. We reached a crossroads, and Ron wanted to go one way, which was shorter, I the other, because I was sure it was the road that Dick would take. Anyway, we marched a few hundred yards my way, and the Germans sided with him in an argument, so we reversed, but we hadn't gone far when an army van arrived with the Hanomag behind. Dick had punctured on the way back, so we'd had to wait. The Germans were put into the truck, and we travelled with them as guards, with Dick driving the Hanomag just behind. When we got back, I was told I was wanted by Australian photographers, newsreel cameramen and war correspondents who had just arrived, and so I had a good story for them. British newsreel men had already been in the camp. They arrived actually the day we were liberated, and they interviewed some of the prisoners. They wanted somebody from each nationality. There was no Scot available, so Peter Thomas, now Lord Thomas, became Jock McPherson, and with a very good Scottish accent gave them the Scottish viewpoint on liberation. George Booth was also interviewed. He, with Larry Slattery, were the first prisoners of the war, shot down on September the 3rd, 1939. He was in the camp, having been marched back, but Slattery, who officially was number one prisoner, and therefore the first prisoner of war of either side, was still on the march. So he became the man who had longest been captive, about 5 years and 9 months. Some of our Polish prisoners heard that the concentration camp to which women captured in the Warsaw insurrection had been taken, had been liberated. And they went off anxiously to see if they could find relatives. They came back absolutely horror-struck because the army had overrun Belsen. That explained the strange stench which had sometimes drifted to the camp. Some of the prisoners went to Belsen. We didn't. Germany now just seemed unclean, and we wanted to be out of it. I thought I'd never want to go back, and in fact I never have. But we still had a few days before we were repatriated. Each day a few hundred men left the camp, the first captured being the first to be evacuated, and we moved then into the cookhouse, where bunks had become vacant and it was much more convenient. All the cars except ours were commandeered by the army. The captain wanted the Hanomag, but allowed us to keep it on condition that we drove him wherever he wanted to go, and that we helped him to keep in check the Russians who were roaming the countryside. The captain was also worried about some of our own less responsible people. He asked us if we could persuade anyone with arms to hand them in. He said that if there were any incidents, the Jerrys would take it out on our friends who were still in their hands. So we took him to one end of the cookhouse, where there were, under a tarpaulin, machine guns and mortars brought in by souvenir hungry prisoners. He hadn't expected, a captain that is, had expected nothing more lethal than a pistol. He really thought he was dreaming. We decided in his honour, and also in honour of his batman, we would have a party in the cookhouse. Well, we had on the table the finest linen, cutlery, lovely wine glasses, cases of wine, all looted from the nearby mansion of a German general, not by us but by our predecessors in the cookhouse who had already gone home. The captain said, "And you were the men who helped me make those poor little Russians take back a few boxes of sultanas." And he ordered a van to take our surplus to the officers' mess. Toby cooked a chicken to perfection, and I cooked a sultana pie. "Oh God, not more sultanas," exclaimed the captain. Well, the wine flowed, and the captain loosed off a few revolver shots through the roof, and had to be prevented from shooting at a German cap, which Toby happened to be wearing when he re-entered the room after going out for air. On April the 26th, Dick, Toby and I were down to go, and Ron had still to wait, as he'd been shot down quite a bit after us. We climbed into an army truck. It was rather uncomfortably packed, and we drove out of the camp. We went in convoy, escorted by motorcyclists, waved on at road junctions, and all about us were wrecked homes, burned out shops, sad looking women, some German prisoners going single file along the roadsides, and we went for some hours, very cramped, and the engine's whine just never stopped. Near Diepholz, we turned into a field. There were hundreds of tents there, with duckboard floors and camp beds. Men queued at the Red Cross tent to get a handout. I couldn't be bothered to queue. Later, I was told that the Red Cross unit was an Australian field unit and they wanted to see me. The man in charge was John Nimmo. He was a Melbourne barrister, and he became one of my dearest friends. He was a judge of the Commonwealth Court, and he put his stamp on certain legislation in Australia, but that was to come. Well, we chatted until 4 o'clock in the morning. From Diepholz we went to Borghurst. That's Borghorst. We spent the night there and most of the day following. There was a visitor's book in the mess. It included the names of Kriegs who'd gone through, some in German ambulances, pinched, some in cars, and some even on a farm tractor. The army had taken over the town. There was a big Naffy canteen and the Monty cinema. We went to the cinema, but we were simply too restless to stay for more than a few minutes, and in fact it was months before I could sit through a film, whereas up till my time in Germany I could see up to 3 films in a day if I were given the chance. Anyway, the next step was to go to the airfield at Rheine to be flown to England. But the day dragged on and we wondered if we would ever get off. The trucks came at last, except for one, and that was the one in which we were to travel. Eventually it came long after the others had gone, and the driver had admitted that he was drunk. There were no more planes due to leave after 6 o'clock, so we urged him to hurry. Well, he drove like fury, and the truck whined and swayed and threatened to capsize, and eventually the driver confessed that he'd lost the way. He was so ashamed that we really didn't find it in ourselves to give him a ticking off. We told him we wouldn't mind another night in Germany. He swore that he'd get us to the airfield on time, and so we set off again and eventually got there long after 6, and the driver just hunched over his wheel and wept. The airfield was desolate, broken, twisted aircraft and burnt out skeletons of aircraft all over the place. Some had nosed into shell craters. There were no more aircraft flying to England that day, but there was a Dakota warming up at the end of the field, and this would take us to Brussels. From there we'd have to begin another journey, but at least Germany, which seems so unclean after the discovery of Belsen, would be behind us. The pilot of the Dakota came over to us. He was a nervous little man, and he said that he couldn't take off yet because there was broken glass all the way down the field, and he said, "You men had better get cracking and pick it up." So we spread out and painstakingly plodded down the field, stooping whenever we saw a piece of glass or sharp metal. I had on my left an Arnhem parachutist, and on my right a man who crash-landed a burning aircraft. And so slowly we walked back to the Dakota, and we heaped our little armfuls of broken glass at the feet of the nervous pilot. Well, we got to Brussels, and I seemed to be shifted from one group to another, kicked out of one group because I was the only Air Force man in it, kicked out of a Air Force group because I was the only Australian. Eventually, I was taken to Ostend and I returned by boat to Tilbury. All the time in Germany, there used to be a slogan, "Roll on that boat." But as far as I know, I was the only one that ever returned by boat.